Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, biographer Alex Navala Lee talks about his latest book, Collisions, A Physicist's Journey from Hiroshima to the Death of the Dinosaurs. It was published by W.W. Norton & Company in June of this year. So also in June at Bio's annual conference in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, I asked Alex Navala Lee about the physicist he brought to life in his biography.
So Luis Alvarez was a Manhattan Project physicist, worked on lots of interesting projects, including most famously the extinction of the dinosaurs. He was the person who, along with his son, demonstrated that that event was caused by an asteroid strike. And he also worked on the Kennedy assassination and did research on things like the president's head snap, you know, whether it might have been caused by a shot from the back as opposed from the front. And so there are many different ways you can encounter Alvarez. People learn about him in different contexts. And I'm pretty sure that I first heard about him via the assassination research years ago. And clearly I was aware of the Alvarez hypothesis, the asteroid impact hypothesis. And what happened is that I think I was just on Wikipedia, and I was reading about him and his life, and I'm always on the lookout for projects that haven't been done yet. And I got to the end, and I realized that there had never been a biography of him, which to me is really astonishing, you know, because his life is so eventful. He did so many interesting things. Like, it's a book that lets you talk about all kinds of really incredible topics. And the idea that no one had done this book yet, again, I was like, clearly this book should exist. I would like to write a book about a scientist at some point. That was one of my objectives. And he seemed like the perfect fit because I always say that Alvarez is probably the smartest person I could plausibly write about, given my background, because I'm not a physicist. You know, I didn't have a background in the sciences. I had to learn a lot of this material, like, to write the book.
And that's what I was going to ask you. That you're not a scientist.
No.
Your background is in classics in terms of your education. So how did you get into writing about science and scientists?
Well, my first two books were kind of science adjacent. So I wrote a book that was a history of science fiction in the 30s and 40s. And then I wrote a book about Buckminster Fuller, who was a kind of a futurologist, science fiction type hero in the real world. And I really wanted to write about a real scientist who had actually done some of the things that these other people had just talked about.
Okay.
The issue, obviously, is that there are certain things I probably am too old to learn. You know, like, I'm at a stage in my life where mastering the math, especially to write about a theoretical physicist, was probably not possible. Or it would be very daunting to do that book properly. Whereas Alvarez, you know, he was an experimenter.
He's called an experimental physicist. So what is an experimental physicist?
That's a great question. So when we think of physics, we tend to think of people at a blackboard writing equations, right? And they're working through principles based on often, like, you know, high-level mathematics. The experimentalists are the ones who can verify the theory. So if theorists predict, you know, a certain kind of particle should exist based on the math, the experimentalist says, okay, let's try to find it. And they have to build the machines usually that are required to define those things. And so Alvarez was a guy who built stuff. You know, he worked at the Berkeley Radiation Lab in the 30s with Ernest Lawrence on the cyclotron, which was like a, you know, groundbreaking piece of physics equipment. And, you know, early on just sort of was known as someone who could solve these problems. You know, he was very hands-on. He knew how to blow glass. He knew how to work in the machine shop. He was very comfortable with that kind of work and with the building these, like, very complex machines to solve particular problems. And I kind of realized, you know, that stuff is, like, a little bit intimidating, you know, to a non-scientist, but I could figure it out. I could kind of approach his life and say, okay, how did these machines work? And he did other things beyond that, you know, that are more theoretical, but, you know, kind of like the core of his achievement is of a person who built tools. And I felt like that was something I could get my head around, and I could explain that to readers in a way that felt responsible.
Right. And the thing that I love about your book is you make the writing about not just his life, but his experiments pretty accessible. I mean, I ran away from the sciences in college, and to read a book about a physicist, I was like, oh God, am I going to really be able to get into this? But it's really fascinating to find out about the man behind the physics. And so how did you approach writing about him to make him accessible to a reader?
I mean, I benefited from the fact that Alvarez, like, his personality is very engaging.
Engaging because, or prickly?
Well,
or both.
Well, it's funny because when I first had the idea to write about him, my obvious first source was his autobiography, because he wrote a memoir that covered, you know, a lot of the material that this book covers. And so you have to ask yourself, you know, why does there need to be a biography to supplement his first person account? And the answer is that in his autobiography, he comes off as a very different figure than the one that eventually emerged from my research. Like, in his autobiography, he seems like a, you know, just kind of like a nice guy, you know, mm-hmm. easygoing, well-liked, which was not always true. He was actually seen as a very difficult person who was hard on people around him, you know, in ways that I think were undeniable. Mm-hmm. And you don't get a single moment in his autobiography where that is obvious. You know, it's not inaccurate, but it's very selective. And so it was kind of almost like a surprise to me, like, after I was already developing the proposal, to realize that, no, he is not just this adventurer who did cool stuff. He had this, like, darker side that almost everyone who knew him was aware of.
And then how did you find that other side?
You look at accounts by his colleagues and his associates, you know. I mean, almost everyone who writes about him mentions this part of his personality, that he was incredibly smart, but very demanding, and had a lot of trouble dealing with his colleagues, his subordinates. He was the kind of person who found it very hard to criticize without making it sound like a personal attack. Because to him, it's like, we're doing physics, this is the game we're playing, what we're doing is really important, and so you should be able to handle this kind of treatment. But a lot of people were really hurt and turned off by the way he would treat you, because he did not sugarcoat his feelings. If he thought you were doing something wrong, he would tell you, and he would expect you to admit your mistakes, like, right away, you know, in a way that I think a lot of people found very unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to interview his surviving relatives?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a huge part of the story, because his most famous achievement was the hypothesis that the dinosaur extinction was caused by an asteroid. And that was a project that he did with his son. So Walter Alvarez, who's still alive and an incredible person in all kinds of ways, you know, they were collaborators. And so getting Walter's side of the story was actually very important to me. And Walter, you know, he's actually a fairly private person. One thing that you will get from the book is that the dinosaur debate was incredibly acrimonious. It was incredibly divisive and heated in ways that seem very hard to imagine now that that theory has become essentially accepted, I'd say, by most scientists. It was really hard on Walter. And I think Walter has been reluctant to talk to the press ever since. Mm. And so it took a long time before I was able to convince him to open up a little bit. And he's still very guarded when it comes to certain personal issues, but incredibly helpful when it came to the factual stuff, checking the manuscript, making sure that all the details were correct. And there are three other children that are still around who I emailed, spoke with over the course of this project. And yeah, they've been, I mean, as a biographer, I haven't always had that experience where the family is essentially receptive to the project. But in this case, they seemed to like the idea that this book was being written. And as far as I know, they seem to like the result.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
So in terms of his accomplishments, he's a Nobel Prize winner, and he won the Nobel Prize for what?
Well, it's funny because I've heard it said, and I kind of agree, that he won the Nobel Prize for the least interesting thing that he ever did. So I mentioned that he built things, and one of the things that he built was a particle detector called the hydrogen bubble chamber, which was a very innovative way to visualize the interactions between particles. You know, you couldn't study these interactions without a tool that would actually let you see these incredible photographs of particle paths and tracks. So, you know, it ended up being a tool that he didn't invent the concept behind the bubble chamber, but he was the one who said, we can scale this up and make a really big one and use it to find things that no one else has seen. And so it was a massive project, took years to develop. But at the end, you know, they used to find, like, new particles that even the theorists never thought could exist, and all kinds of discoveries that I think we're actually like very serendipitous. You know, I talked about, you know, theorists versus experimenters. And for the most part, experimenters are looking for particles that the theorists have already said might exist. Mm-hmm. But Alvarez invented this tool, the bubble chamber, that actually let you find things that no one had expected, which, you know, I think is a key point about that technology.
Like, right.
And he also, and this is another thing that I find really interesting, he developed the computational systems that you can use to analyze the data. So this is actually, in some ways, his biggest legacy on that front, because the bubble chamber generates millions of photographs. You know, you have more information than any one person or any one team of people could possibly process, unless you had computer-assisted technology.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the one who said, not only will I develop this machine, but I'm going to develop the data analysis systems that we can use to analyze the output. And it made a huge difference because for the first time, instead of just like manually going through all these pictures, you could have a computer plot all this stuff and just kind of flip through the results and look for interesting bumps in the data. And that, you know, was a huge tool that, you know, obviously affected the way physics is practiced even now.
And so amazingly enough, early in his career, he was part of the Manhattan Project, as you mentioned earlier. So what was his role, one, in that project? And I guess throughout his life, he consistently felt that the use of the atomic bomb was justified. So could you talk about his thinking about that and, of course, his role in the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, no, this is a very dramatic story. So during World War II, his first role was working on radar. And again, like radar, the bomb, you know, these are things where he didn't necessarily have the background in advance to work on these projects, but he was known as being a smart, organized guy who could run teams and come up with ideas. No matter what the problem was, you could bring him in and he would have useful things to contribute. So after radar, you know, he was brought on essentially by Oppenheimer personally to work on the Manhattan Project and, you know, did a range of things. But the one that ended up being really important was he designed the detonation system for the plutonium bomb. So Fat Man and Trinity, these are bombs that are based on implosion, which is a very difficult process that required an immense amount of work. And without Alvarez's detonator system, I don't think it would have been a functional weapon. So, you know, he had a huge role in the design of the bomb, but then he also decided he wanted to be there when it was used.
Right.
And he kind of, this is something that he personally wanted. And so he actually arranged to be the lead scientific observer at Hiroshima. Because he said, oh, we're going to drop this bomb. Someone should be there to measure the explosive force, and we need to figure out a way to do this. And so he comes up with this system of parachute gauges he would drop from an observation plane.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a useful idea, but I think it really was like a rationale for him to be there when it happened,
right.
Which is, you know, unique. He was the most senior person from the Manhattan Project who actually saw that first bomb being used. So in the book, I talk about how he was in the observation plane. He saw, you know, the bomb being dropped and the results. And famously, on the flight back, he began to write a letter to his son, Walt, who was 4 at the time, saying, you know, we've just dropped this bomb. Here's what happened. And here's why I think it was justified. And his feelings about that stayed pretty consistent. Like, he always defended the use of those bombs. And his justification was, he'd already seen that the U.S. was prepared to firebomb Japan using conventional incendiaries, and he'd seen the consequences. Like, he'd seen that Tokyo and other major cities in Japan had been firebombed with horrifying results, I mean, massive casualties. And his argument was that if we hadn't dropped the atomic bombs, that firebombing would have just continued. I mean, Hiroshima and Nagasaki would have been firebombed anyway, you know, with as many casualties probably as would have resulted from the atomic bombs. And he said that we actually saved lives on the Japanese side as well as the American side by dropping those bombs, ending the war, and preventing the firebombing campaign that he was positive and I think correct in assuming that the United States was prepared to pursue. So again, you can argue whether or not that is a correct way of looking at the issue, but he made that point very forcefully, and he never really wavered from that.
And did he ever really consider, say, the moral responsibility of developing this bomb that not only was going to be used in Japan to essentially it ended the war, but that it would have future consequences in other wars, or could have?
Yeah, no, he was very, I would say, hawkish in some ways when it came to using nuclear weapons. He was definitely on the side of developing the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb, which is like much more destructive than, you know, the bombs that were used during World War II. He, you know, became a proponent of mutual assured destruction and sort of, you know, the way the arms race evolved. In contrast to Oppenheimer, you know, so these two men are very similar in some ways. You know, they come from similar places, but they end up on opposite sides. Mm-hmm. And I think one reason is that Oppenheimer, after the war, he felt he was done and he could go off and do other things and felt free to, like, you know, expound upon his feelings about arms control. And Alvarez was still at Berkeley, and, you know, his funding was tied up intimately with, like, the government's military defense policy. And so Alvarez very cautiously, I think, avoided criticizing the government on a lot of issues because he knew that to achieve his own objectives, he had kind of stay on the good side of the people in power. That said, I mean, I'm not saying he didn't believe these things too, but he was a part of that system in a way that someone like Oppenheimer was not.
And you think that's why when Oppenheimer was up for whether or not they were going to continue his security clearance, that Alvarez didn't speak in favor of his colleague slash friend?
Yeah, I unpack this at length in the book, but Alvarez was one of the few scientists, along with Edward Teller, to testify for the government during the Oppenheimer security hearing. And I think he did believe that Oppenheimer was a risk. I'm not saying that he wasn't justified on some level, but I also think that he had an interest in neutralizing Oppenheimer because they were entering this period where stuff like the super, you know, hydrogen bomb was being discussed, and Oppenheimer and Alvarez were on opposing sides. And I think Alvarez said, well, to kind of get the program to where it needs to be, we have to get Oppenheimer out of the picture. And I do think that was his goal there.
Okay. You talked about using Alvarez's memoirs to help you with the process of writing your book. What other resources did you use, and how accessible were some of the government sources that you may have had to resort to?
Yeah, and I mean, I would never have taken on this project if I didn't know there was an archive. You know, I mean, that's like, as a biographer, you know, that is like the first thing you want. You want to know that you can go to like one place, ideally, and there are going to be boxes full of correspondence. And in his case,
anyway.
Yes. And so Alvarez's, you know, papers are archived at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. They contain incredible stuff. You know, for one thing, it has the uncut draft of the memoir. Mm. So the memoir was cut in half, essentially, for publication. And so there was a lot of interesting material that I didn't see print that I was able to use. And, you know, obviously correspondence. Fewer things on the personal side. You know, his personal life is not reflected in those archives. But I did end up looking at a family archive that was kept by one of his kids that had, again, like crates of materials that weren't available elsewhere. And that emerged solely because, you know, I had reached out to the family, and they had things that no one had ever seen before. And things like his FBI file, you know, were incredibly insightful, you know, things that he wouldn't talk about. There was an abundance of material that I could work with, you know, that was not that hard to find.
And I love the way you incorporate his personal life when you talk about, say, his first wife and the second wife and, you know, his kids. So you see him not just in the science world, but also personally.
Yeah, and that was actually kind of challenging because there's a pattern I've seen with some of the people I've written about where they are married twice, and the first wife kind of gets erased from the story, you know, because she's someone who was present during an earlier stage, and there's a tendency to kind of minimize her contribution. I think that's certainly true here. I think Geraldine, his first wife, was clearly an incredibly intelligent person who was his partner in a lot of ways, you know, like before and during the war. And she played a big role in the lives of their kids. Right. You know, Walter, I think, became a geologist because his mother encouraged him. Alvarez Sr., his father, did not find geology to be interesting until toward the very end when they were collaborating on this extinction theory. But Geraldine definitely encouraged Walter's interest. And so, you know, without her, the whole dinosaur story would not have happened.
Mm-hmm. What was your writing process?
So World War II, the Manhattan Project, these are all things that are part of the story, and they are huge subjects. Like, there's no way I could possibly cover up everything, like, on my own. So what I ended up doing is, based on the Alvarez papers and kind of the essential sources, I wrote a first draft of the book fairly quickly, just so I knew what the structure was and kind of what the narrative beats were going to be.
Well, when you say fairly quickly, what it
I mean, means? I would say after about a year and a half, I had a first draft. And that's a year and a half from when the project started to when I finished the epilogue, you know, in rough draft form. But then what I did is that I went back and then I read all the books about World War II and the Manhattan Project that I could. because if I were reading those books at the beginning, I don't know what facts are going to be useful to me to tell the Alvarez story. And so I'd be underlining every page, you know, like, okay, maybe I'll need this later. Whereas if I've written the entire first draft of the book, I can read an entire book about the Manhattan Project and say, okay, here are the two details I didn't have that I should probably incorporate. And that actually ended up being like a pretty good approach for this book because, again, it would have taken a long time to work through all those materials if I did that first. But, you know, kind of like knowing what the book was helped me be more selective and a little bit more intelligent about how I use those sources in the end.
All right. And how easy or difficult was it to sell this book?
So the short version is that I actually switched publishers. My previous two books had been with HarperCollins, and this new one is with Norton. And part of the reason is that I think Norton was better prepared to deal with this kind of subject because Alvarez, although incredible in lots of ways, he's not a household name.
Right.
And so there is this kind of like two-stage process where you have to explain who he was to people and then convince them to buy the book. And I think Norton is better equipped to deal with that kind of project.
Were you also drawn to Alvarez because of your shared Bay Area background?
To some extent, yeah. So I was born in the East Bay in Castro Valley, California. And so I went to Berkeley a lot growing up. And I love Berkeley, all right? So Alvarez was associated with UC Berkeley and the Lawrence Berkeley Lab for most of his career. And yeah, no, it was delightful. Like, I got to hang out there. I got to go to, you know, the lab and see his, you know, what used to be his office and kind of think about the culture of that place and time. I mean, it was not really intentional. Like, I don't think I consciously, you know, thought of that as like a element that would draw me to the story. But once I was there, I was like, this is great. I get to hang out in one of my favorite parts of the country.
He was born in San Francisco. So did you find that you had to go to some of his childhood haunts to really get a sense of what he was like as a kid?
I like doing that when I can. I did that in Berkeley because I have his addresses. And so there was one day in Berkeley where I went on a walking tour. And I realized that I'd allotted, 3 hours maybe to like walk from place to place because that's how much Google Maps, you know, said I should you know, plan for. But I forgot that Berkeley is very hilly.
Yep, it is.
And a lot of his addresses were at the very top. Like, he liked places with like a nice view.
So he was not a flatland kind of guy.
No. It's really funny because I'm like, there's a pattern here. Like, these houses all have like nice views. And so it was a hike. But yeah, no, definitely like seeing his houses, seeing how they changed over time. You know, for example, you know, when he became a more prominent figure at Berkeley, he needed a big house to hold meetings of his students. And, you know, that was a big part of like the Alvarez group's culture, is that these meetings they would have at his house where he would serve cookies and beer, and they would do these like wide-ranging talks about physics and science and all kinds of interesting topics. But yeah, and that was kind of the community he was building. And I saw the house. I'm like, okay, well, this makes sense. Like, this is the kind of house he would need to hold those kinds of gatherings.
Good. His name, if you see his name in print, you would think, oh, how did this Latin American gentleman move through the science community that he did? And yet, I guess the question is, did he experience any discrimination based on his name?
Yes. So I should clarify that Luis Alvarez was not a person of color. He was Spanish American on his father's side. So Alvarez is a perfectly, you know, reasonable Spanish name, but he was a white man. And there's some confusion about this that I expect will persist. So the answer is, you know, he certainly enjoyed all the benefits of white privilege for a person of his time. Occasionally there would be confusion. And there's one really funny story where when he first went to Los Alamos, he had to find housing for himself and his wife and his son. And he learned later on that when his neighbors in that building learned that the, quote, Alvarezes were moving in, they got kind of uncomfortable because that name they would associate with, like, the people that did the cleaning and, like, you know, like the sort of the staff members, you know, at Los Alamos.
Right.
And they feared they would lose social standing if they shared a house with someone with the last name Alvarez. And so the woman in charge of those logistics had to explain to them, no, this is a senior scientist. You know, you're not going to experience any social issues by having this guy next door. But, you know, that last name for certain people, you know, I think raised a red flag.
Wow. Do you have any recommendations for other writers who are interested in working on a biography about a scientist?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an incredible kind of untapped field. I mean, there's still, you know, interesting figures from this time period who haven't been covered. And, you know, I would say don't be too daunted by the science. I think going in, you know, I was a little worried about the physics, obviously. But, you know, if you're picking one person's life, unless they are like a figure like Fermi, who just kind of like spans the whole range of physics, you know, you can focus on particular projects. And these days, you do have lots of tools that you can use to help you understand the concepts, which I found very helpful. And also just talking to the right people. Like, I benefited enormously, you know, not just from talking to Alvarez's colleagues, but from getting reads from them. Like, Walter Alvarez, for example, read the sections on the dinosaur extinction hypothesis and caught, like, little errors or things that he said that, you know, a geologist would notice. You know, maybe not like a general reader, you know, because I'm trying to, like, simplify things and, like, make things more accessible to, you know, lay readers. But he said, no, this is too simple. Like, you've kind of misstated what the facts are here, so just make this one little fix and it'll be fine. And again, like, most readers might never notice that stuff, but obviously I'm very glad that I got that kind of read, and I think that's an essential part of the process.
Were you able to speak to other physicists to get that background information that you needed about the science?
Yeah, I mean, I know some physicists socially, and so I got some reads from them. And, you know, obviously talking to Alvarez's colleagues, you know, most of them are physicists and they have expertise not just in their own field, but in general. And so whenever I got reads from people, you know, they would often like not just like flag things in the sections they knew best, but also, oh, well, this part here, you should probably restate this to make it more clear. You know, a physicist might not find this explanation persuasive. So, yeah, so definitely having like that kind of brain trust of readers was very helpful.
Excellent. Well, anything else you want to add about this book?
Well, I mean, I encourage people, obviously, to read it, not just because I think it's inherently interesting, but I think it gets at bigger themes. I mean, these are themes I tend to return to, but, you know, what are the limits of intelligence? Because Alvarez, to me, is unquestionably a genius, unquestionably one of the most talented, brightest people I could imagine. But, you know, he had his flaws, and there are things that he was reluctant to say because he also respected power and he respected influence, and he wanted that for himself in a way that, you know, maybe Oppenheimer did not, and Oppenheimer paid the price. I think Alvarez, like, saw what Oppenheimer suffered and was determined to never let that happen to him. And so I think he is very cautious in certain ways about pushing back against some of the assumptions, let's say, of his time. And there are certain problems that, as a result, he couldn't really solve or he couldn't really have useful advice on. And I think that's really revealing, you know, that even someone like Alvarez, who had all the tools you could possibly want to think about the biggest issues imaginable, you know, felt constrained in some ways, you know, in what he could say.
Did you find yourself being cautious about, say, exploring some of Alvarez's flaws because you knew that his relatives would be reading your book?
Yeah, no question. I mean, and there were certainly things that I solicited feedback and took those notes very seriously. But I think even his family and closest colleagues are aware of the kind of challenging person he was. I mean, maybe it hadn't been discussed publicly before in quite this way, but, you know, they knew who this guy was. They loved him, you know, despite the fact that he could be difficult. And I think they understand that any accurate picture of his accomplishment needs to acknowledge that side of his personality. And so I'm actually very grateful that they saw it that way. And I think you can't understand this kind of figure without talking about the costs and some of the emotional issues that came up. And I'm actually very glad that, you know, his family and friends seem to agree.
Well, thank you so much, Alec. I really enjoyed the book. I didn't think I would because it's like, oh, science.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm actually really relieved to hear that, too.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
That was author Alex Navala Lee speaking with me about his latest book, Collisions, A Physicist's Journey from Hiroshima to the Death of the Dinosaurs. It was published by W.W. Norton & Company in June of this year, and this interview was recorded in June at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., during BIO's annual conference. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.